Okay, so I'm Paulina McDougall, and this is July 11th, 2012, and I'm interviewing Terrence Hughes, who was a faculty member at the Quaternary Institute. So could you tell me a little bit about how you got interested in glaciers? I noticed on the website that you started out in metallurgy and then became interested in glaciers somehow.
Mm-hmm. Well, the very first awareness was growing up on the Hughes Cattle Ranch in South Dakota on the west side, just on the west side of the Missouri River, because the east side of the river, the ground was more fertile soil brought down from Canada by the ice sheet and had a lot of erratic boulders scattered all over it, which made it a lot different from the west side. And so that's quite of a, you know, for a young boy, that's quite a mind-boggling concept that ice thousands of feet thick could strip off the top of Canada and bring it down and dump it on South Dakota all the way to the Missouri River. So that sort of remained dormant in my mind. I went to the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology after I graduated from high school, originally thinking I'd like to be an architect because I always liked to design things. But my mother developed cancer when I was in my late teens, and my dad had to sell the cattle ranch to try to save her life. She died when I was 19. But anyway, that meant that I had to put myself through college, and the School of Mines, the tuition was only $90 a year back then. So any kid with any kind of a summer job could save $90 and put himself through college, which is what I did, along with my two brothers. And I picked metallurgy. I don't know how much details you want to go into, but the reason I picked metallurgy is that those freshmen like myself who didn't really know what branch of engineering you wanted to enter were taken to the gymnasium where the chairman of each department would be on the stage and give us reasons why we should go into their particular branch of engineering. And Paul Anderson appeared and told us that metallurgists were the highest paid engineers. Well, they got my attention right away. And then he told us the secret of Damascus steel. And anybody who's read The Talisman or any of these other tales of that kind would be aware of the fabled properties of Damascus steel. There's the old, you know, one story in there is when Richard the Lionheart had to impress Saladin, used his broadsword to slice through a small tree, and Saladin responded by having a eunuch bring a silk scarf to him on a pillow and motion for the eunuch to toss the scarf up in the air, and when it floated down, he sliced it into little pieces with his scimitar made of Damascus steel. So it was quite impressive. Well, the secret was all in the quench. It was heated the color of the setting sun and then quenched in the belly of Nubian slaves. So anyway, so that added kind of a romantic element to metallurgy, and I have kind of a romantic streak in me, so the practical streak, the good salaries and the romantic streak sort of came together, and I decided to be a metallurgist. Well, I went to graduate school at Northwestern. A new department had been created called Material Science, which was metallurgy expanded to include polymers and ceramics. And so I was a larger field with more job prospects at the end of the line. And so I picked that as opposed to other places where I could have gone. And while there, I like to browse through the Deering Library, just a short walk from the Technological Institute that housed all the engineering departments. And I always had a lot of other interests besides science and engineering, and saw a book on the shelf that nobody had ever read called Those Astounding Ice Ages. It was written by Dolph Earl Hooker, who was a retired architect, and that was the profession that I would have preferred to have entered if I could have afforded it, schooling in it. And so I checked it out, and he had a kind of a crazy idea about the origin of ice ages, which I won't go into. But I showed it to Hans Wertmann, who was a faculty member of the Material Science Department, and I knew he had written some theoretical papers on ice ages and the big continental ice sheets. So I showed him the book, and he got a letter from Colin Bull, who is the director of the Institute of Polar Studies, asking if there was a graduate student there who'd be interested in going to Antarctica on one of the glaciological expeditions. Well, I had just spent a year traveling around the world right after I wrote my doctoral dissertation, and I left it with my advisor. I took a year off and traveled around the world, and when I came back, that's when I saw and read this book, and Wertmann got this letter from Colin Bull, and so I thought, well, I got kind of hooked on traveling, and been over to, 64 countries, I think, in a space of a year, traveling mostly overland, and including both of the Americas, Asia, and Europe and Africa. So all the continents except Australia and Antarctica. Well, this was a chance to visit Antarctica, so I was still single and thought I didn't have any real responsibilities. I was just finishing one part of my life and ready to start another one, so I had a little period in between where I could do something unusual. So I thought, I'll give it a try. I'll take this opportunity to go to Antarctica. And so I accepted that job as opposed to for $12,000 a year, where I could have gotten $18,000 at Los Alamos Laboratories and at the Inland Steel in East Chicago, Indiana, or Rocketdyne Corporation in California, the Division of North American Aviation. Those are the other jobs I could have taken for more money. But bubble bug to see the world, especially a place like Antarctica, was trumped the extra $6,000 that I walked away from. And I selected the Institute of Polar Studies. It was called at that time, now it's called the Byrd Polar Research Center. On that occasion, there was a New Zealand graduate student named Jerry Holdsworth, who had done his master's on Meserve Glacier in Antarctica. It's a cold-based glacier. Ice was frozen to the bed, unlike the warm-based glaciers that you have in the Alps and the Andes and other places around the world in more temperate latitudes. And he wanted to drill holes through the glacier from along the center line. But they found a spot on his chest x-ray that would let him go down. So I was the only one on the team. The others were students, and I had just gotten a PhD. I didn't know anything about drilling, I didn't know anything about glaciers, but because I had that magical PhD, I was put in charge. They went down, and we succeeded in drilling the holes through the glacier. They had the original drilling technique that Holdsworth had put in the proposal didn't work, and so I tried two other ways of doing it. The third one worked, and so I got the holes drilled, and then I got a chance to go by way of the South Pole to the Plateau Station, which is the most remote research station in American Sand in Antarctica, to log a hole into the ice that had been drilled a year earlier. log temperatures in that hole, and so I did that. And,
well, that's not a
bug. And on the way back from Antarctica, I took about 6 months traveling by way of New Zealand, Australia, and up through Southeast Asia, you know, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Burma, India, Nepal, and then Southern Asia, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, and then up through Western Europe, through the Scandinavian countries, on a fishing boat to Greenland from the Faroe Islands, and then returned on a flight over the North Pole to Alaska, and came back into the United States by that way, and starting off to see the Grand Canyon, hiked down to the bottom. And when I came back, I told the director, Colin Bull, who hired me at the old Institute of Polar Studies, that I would like to do this, and I still had one or two of those job offers being held open for me. So if he thought I was being too irresponsible, it was okay. He could find someone else for that job, and I'd pick one of these other two jobs. I got my chance to visit Antarctica. But when I returned, he had the job still kept open for me. So I had fun. It was fun drilling, finding a way to drill those holes in the glacier and logging the temperatures and the inclination, and the other one up at Plateau Station. The challenge, and then getting a chance to see a lot of these other countries on the way back. And I thought, well, if a glaciologist's job that allows you to do this, see these faraway places, and do other sightseeing going to and from these places, it'd be crazy to take a job where I'd be at some lab for the rest of my life doing something that wouldn't be anywhere near as interesting and fun. So I stayed there. Well, it's just a research appointment, a research scientist, but the people arranged for me to get a tenure-track position in the civil engineering department, but then there's an opportunity to come to the University of Maine, where I would be teaching at that time was the geology department, as one half of a joint appointment in was then called the Institute for Quaternary Studies. And Hal Borns was both the director of the Institute and the chairman of the department. And I met him and George Denton at a meeting in Skyland, which was a place in the Blue Mountains of Virginia, where the National Science Foundation held orientation a week every year for people going to Antarctica.
We're going to do the Walmart run, and we'll be back in a couple hours.
Tell me a little bit about that first trip to Antarctica. What was that like?
What was it like?
Yeah.
Well, it was at that time. It wasn't so much different from the heroic age of Antarctic exploration and discovery. We went down by plane, but once we got out into the field, we were pretty much on our own. We were serviced by helicopters, and that still is the case today. But it was in its infancy, that kind of research. That was the first cold glacier that had ever been drilled through in Antarctica or anywhere else. So it was a pioneering study. And back then, graduate students could write and get funded research proposals from NSF. Jerry Holdsworth wrote the proposal that got that drilling project funded. That doesn't happen anymore, and if you read any of those accounts of by people that date from the what I call the founding generation of glaciology, this would be people like Charlie Bentley and a fellow who's still active, who's written books, is John. His last name slips my mind for some reason right now. Anyway, there's still a number of them still around, and reading their accounts of what they did isn't so much different from reading the accounts of John Behrendt, Behrendt, mm-hmm. is the fellow, University of Colorado. And then the accounts of Scott and Amundsen and Mawson and all these other early explorers of Antarctica.
Had you read those before you went down there?
I told you, there's a romantic streak in me, and there was, and I was able to live it to mm-hmm. some extent back then. Whereas now it's still there. It's still there. I think it'll always be there because Antarctica is an unforgiving environment. But it's become a kind of routine now. Whereas back then, it was still high adventure.
Mm-hmm. Were you already aware of the history of the exploration that took place before? Some of the Scott and Shackleton things before you went down there?
I'm dimly aware of it. Mm-hmm. Not as I am now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was aware of them, but the details, their diaries and journals and that kind of thing, the books they wrote, no.
Yeah.
But I knew they were a special breed of people. We all did. Well, they still are.
Yeah, you mentioned that the first way or first method of drilling didn't work. Can you tell me a little bit about that? I mean, was it because of the harsh environment you had to try different ways of drilling?
No, it was the drilling technique that geophysical prospectors use when they have to go through rock to get down hundreds or even thousands of feet. And take out cores of rock, and then it's basically used for exploring for petroleum, oil, and natural gas, that sort of thing. But any kind of minerals, anything that has value that is deep down in the below the Earth's surface. Why that technique didn't work in Antarctica was because there are about 10-foot lengths of pipe that are screwed together, and then the core comes up the center of a pipe, and what had to be done for drilling through ice is the ice core. We wanted to recover an ice core, but the drilling technique was through a solid material, ice, that melts when the friction of the drilling head is turning on it. And so there had to be and that would eventually clog inside the pipe, and the core coming up inside the pipe, and also between the outside wall of the pipe and the hole, get clogged with these ice chips. And so we had to have a drilling fluid used that would melt the ice, the chips, and allow the drilling to continue. But no one had done that before, so we didn't really know if it would work. And it didn't work because the chips would, when the drilling fluid came back up the hole, with the chips supposedly dissolved, but not completely. We had a system of screens that would screen out the ice chips that hadn't dissolved so we could reuse the drilling fluid. Otherwise, you'd be had to have just the barrels and barrels of drilling fuel brought in by helicopters, making it a very expensive operation. Well, the screens did not really get rid of the small chips of ice, suspended nuclei that would enlarge and eventually clogged the plumbing system that was used. And so the pipes from the pump that would circulate, get to the pump that would circulate the drilling fluid, eventually burst. Because especially on the elbows where these ice chips would couldn't make the turns, would pile up. So we just had to abandon it completely. There was a mechanical drilling approach based on what was called a SIPRI ice auger. SIPRI is an acronym for the Snow, Ice, and Permafrost Laboratory that was originally in, I think it was Winnetka, Illinois, and later transferred to the Coal Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory in Hanover, New Hampshire, where it remains today. And there you can, it's just about a 1 meter tube that has aluminum rods that connect to it, each about 3 feet long, and you just turn it with a handle at the top, and you never get down the full 3 feet. You usually get two and a half feet, and then you have to pull it all up, take out the core, and then go down again. It's a very slow process, but when you're going some hundreds of feet into a glacier, that had never been done before. It was quite shallow drilling that was used. And we found that we had the same problem when we got down to a certain depth. The chips that were created by the cutting tools, it's turning at the bottom of this core barrel, where it would get between the core barrel and the wall of the hole, and just make it impossible after a while to continue to turn the auger. So we had to abandon that. And at the warehouse in McMurdo Station, there was a set of flight augers, which is nothing but steel rods that have an inclined plane wrapped around them that are used, you see them on ranches out here in the west for drilling post holes for fence posts. And they're quite common everywhere. Well, they had a set of those, a couple hundred feet of them, and so I talked to people, USARP, U.S. Antarctic Research Program people, that's what it was called back then. Let me use them on Reserve Glacier. And so I had the machine shop build a connector that would connect them to the engine that would turn the slide augers. We wouldn't have to do it by hand. And they're quite heavy, you know, they're all steel, not aluminum, like the SIPRI ice auger and the connecting rods. And that worked. We were able to do it. We didn't get a core, but we did get the three holes that Jerry Holdsworth wanted to drill. We did log them for temperature and inclination. So, we succeeded just by not giving up, not quitting.
So did you do all of that work down there in Antarctica, or did you have to go back and forth?
We went down two years later, to re-log the holes for the nation in particular, because the ice is flowing, and it's shearing over the bed, so the ice at the surface is faster than the ice at the bed, which is virtually zero for the ice is frozen in the bed. And so you get a bending, and the holes will get bent to match the deformation of the ice. And there's an inclinometer, which is kind of a compass with a target on it, and a pendulum that points away from the bullseye on the target to tell you the inclination of the tube that contains this pendulum and the compass. And there's a little camera there inside that photographs where the pendulum is on the target, and also a thermocouple that records the temperature. So we had to re-log those, because it takes a while. equilibrated in the hole to the surrounding ice temperature. So the original temperatures we got were fine, you know, but they weren't as accurate as you get a year or two later. Well, Jerry Holdsworth went down a year later, and he was unable to get those measurements. So, well, I got down to Deception Island. That was 68. In October of 1970, there was an eruption on Deception Island, which is on the other side of Antarctica, just north of the Antarctic Peninsula. And a group of us from the old Institute of Polar Studies who went down there with people from other countries to study the results of that eruption, and that was my second glaciological project was there. But Olav Orheim was a Norwegian graduate student at the time, and I was signed on to be his field assistant for his doctoral research doing the mass balance on glaciers on Deception Island. And then afterwards, he and I took a supply ship to McMurdo and then went in and we were able to relog those holes that we had that I drilled 2 years earlier. So then I took a third trip back to the United States, which was I went to New Guinea. I wanted to see the Sepik River where the most recent cannibals are supposed to live. And I took a canoe about 300 miles down the Sepik River and then New Guinea and up in the Bismarck Mountains and saw the natives perform what they call a sing sing for tourists. And then I went to Macau and Hong Kong and Yokohama by boat, and then took another boat to Nakutka on the Russian Pacific coast, and then a train, a Trans-Siberian Railroad to Moscow, and then another train to Luxembourg, and then flew back to the United States from there. So I did another trip around the world on that occasion as well. That would have been the third time I've been around the world. Again, because I picked glaciology, and I had at the old Institute of Polar Studies, they allowed me to get away with that kind of thing as long as I finished the projects I was doing. So, at the Deception Island, the project I had there was the 1970 eruption in August blew the end off of a glacier that Deception Island is a horseshoe-shaped caldera, and it's flooded through a breach called Neptune's Bellows, so that the interior crater is full of seawater. It's called Port Foster, and the Brits and the Argentines and the Chileans all had stations there. They all three claimed that part of the Antarctic pie, and so, you know, south of South America, and Olav Orheim specialized in mass balance glaciology, balancing what enters a glacier by snow and what leaves a glacier by melting or calving of icebergs. And but I was more interested in ice dynamics and eruption had blown the front off of a glacier that came from the caldera rim down into Port Foster. And it created a nice cliff 100 meters high where slabs of ice were calving. And I thought this would be a chance to study calving dynamics. It was the first one that had been done in a really detailed way. It's quite a dangerous part of glaciology to study, a phenomenon to study in glaciology, because these calving events are quite unpredictable. And if you're going to be working on the calving front, you know, you could be there at the time a slab breaks off, and you and it go down together into the sea. So anyway, we did it. I dug about I think it was something like 30 meters of tunneling, three different tunnels. At different heights on this ice wall, ice cliff, into the ice cliff to see the shear dynamics that was causing these slabs to calve. It was sort of like bending it, holding a deck of cards vertically and then bending the deck and the slabs that would break off, was sort of like peeling cards off of the deck. Well, the process of peeling, of the deck of cards bending forward causes shear displace from one card to the next. And as the leading card bends forward, the gravity will want to peel it away from the shear face it has with the card behind it. And so we wanted to tunnel into the wall and see how much shear was taking place between these slabs as they moved toward the calving front. And it's at three different heights. And we did that, and and no one got hurt from any of it. And all on, that was my first project that I got funded myself, drilling through Missouri Glacier in the Dry Valleys. That was Jerry Holdsworth's project. I was just put in charge of it because he couldn't go down that year. But this was the first one that had been funded, and the one who funded it was Dick Cameron. He was a program manager for glaciology at the time, and he was also at Ohio State, so I knew Dick personally. Sorry, I take that back. It was James Wally who had funded that. And Dick had been program manager, but I think he came on a bit later. He's still at Ohio State at that time, Dick Cameron. He's still around, you know. I still correspond with Dick by email. Mm-hmm. And Jay Zwally. Well, that was a two-year study because I put in a lot of stakes, strain networks. The people who went down with me who were graduate students there at Ohio State. And one of them was Claire Parkinson, who was a graduate student in the geography department. And so she's the first woman to go to Antarctica on a mixed male-female expedition, who was an American expedition. And she has gone on to, and she was hired by NASA after that to be a glaciologist who she specialized in sea ice and then climatology. Has written several books, or I have all of them, on that subject. And she's still there, a very highly respected scientist at NASA with a world-class reputation. I keep in touch with her, too. Mm-hmm. She's received many prestigious awards. I haven't gotten any myself. I had to get one, the gold plate medal from the Bird Polar Research Center, which is the old Institute of Polar Studies. And I do like that one because it's named after Dick Goldthwait, who founded that institute. And he was still there when I was hired in 1968. So it was kind of I had a personal connection with that particular award, which I wouldn't have with any other award, which I didn't get. I didn't get any other ones, but that one I would have treasured more than any of the other ones that might have come my way for that reason. I knew the man for whom that award was named, the medal.
Can I ask you another question?
I might have left it there in the climate changes. I think I gave it to the Institute to put in its showcase. I'm not sure about that. You can check that out.
We will. We'll ask about it. Can I ask you a little more general question about why it's important to understand ice sheet calving?
Well, you see, it was a neglected part of glaciology for two reasons. The first one was the inherent dangers that I already mentioned. The second one, calving is when ice left the glaciological system. So glaciologists, generally didn't have any interest in that, once ice was gone, it's off the radar screen for glaciologists. So there wasn't any really serious work done. until I did the work on Deception Island. But since then, it interested me because ice dynamics, it was more of a direct application of my background in material science and metallurgy, was studying the deformation of crystalline solids using shear deformations localized on discrete planes. And I had become knowledgeable about how that's done with metals and metal alloys and other materials when I was a student. So that's where my interest took me, rather than the mass balance sort of branch of glaciology that I've studied. Well, when I moved to Maine, the big sweetener was having a joint appointment in the old Institute of Polar Studies, now the Climate Change Institute, and the old Department of Geology, which is now the School of
Earth Science,
Climate Sciences,
yeah.
I think. But there was always a connection there at the University of Maine between these branches of science like glaciology and glacial geology and archaeology and anthropology and ecology, all those things, and climate, because climate was climate change was the common denominator that tied all those things together. And when I was hired by Hal Barnes, George Denton had just taken on responsibility for CLIMAP. CLIMAP is at the University of Maine. CLIMAP is an acronym for Climate Long Range Investigation, Mapping, and Prediction. And it was a project of the International Decade of Ocean Exploration from 1970 to 1980. And John Embry at Brown University and his Milba Kipp, chief technician, primarily had come up with a way to get climate records from the concentration of microorganisms in ocean floor sediments. These organisms are the skeletons of diatoms and forams and other single-cell plants or animals of that kind that lived near or at the surface of the oceans, and when they died, the skeletons went down to the seafloor, either made of silica or calcium skeletons. They all have a distinctive skeleton. They're like fingerprints. And they all thrive at temperatures and salinities where they live that are known. Those temperatures and salinities are known because a lot of these organisms are still in the oceans today. And so what it was is a record from their skeletons could be identified microscopically of what those temperatures and salinities were in the past. And Embry and Kipp had come up with transfer functions which quantified that relationship between the concentration of these microorganisms in ocean cores and the temperatures and salinities that would have allowed those relative concentrations to exist at the time these organisms were alive. And so it was a way to actually map the ocean surface temperatures in the past, going back to 20,000 years or more, the time span for accurate radiocarbon dating. And so that's what they wanted to do. That time span included the last glacial maximum. And so that was the main thing CLIMAP wanted to map, was the Earth's environment at that time. They picked 18,000. someone who would, they had very primitive computer models at that time. They needed someone who would reconstruct the ice sheets that existed back then, because the ice sheets provided the major boundary conditions for climate at that time that are different from the conditions today. Specifically, the height of the ice sheets forced the surface winds, and especially the westerlies, and also, but also the jet stream, to be diverted around primarily the southern margin of these northern hemisphere ice sheets, but also partly around the northern margin. And so that's different from what it is today, where it's all close to sea level in Canada and Siberia and these other places where ice sheets existed in the past. The other thing was the volume of the ice could be used to calculate how much the sea level had lowered at that time in the past, and therefore the area of the continental shelves that were exposed then but aren't today. So the volume of the ice sheets was something that was needed in these computer models, because the major driving force is the ocean to the atmosphere heat exchange. That was for climate, it still is. And so the area of the ocean surface is a very important variable to keep track of, because that's where that heat exchange takes place. The more area of that kind you have, the more exchange there is. And also the sea ice cover is important too, because that also puts a lid on that surface. It suppresses that exchange.
Sorry, that's my phone. I'll just ignore it.
All right. Well, so the third thing was the aerial extent. I mean, what area on the Earth's surface are covered by the ice sheets? Because the ice sheets are a white surface that reflects most of the incoming solar radiation. And so the fraction of the aerial extent of ice sheets on the Earth's surface reduces the fraction of solar radiation that actually gets absorbed by the planet to support life. And if you have a lot of that heat reflected back into space by ice sheets, then the habitable parts of the Earth for plants and animals is reduced. And that includes sea surface, too, where you have creatures that live in the ocean. So, to get those boundary conditions for these primitive atmospheric circulation models was necessary to know the elevation and the volume and the aerial extent of former ice sheets. Well, that needed the glacial geologists to get the aerial extent, and it needed glaciologists to get the vertical height and the thickness mapped over the areas where they were glaciated by these big ice sheets. Well, George Denton was the glacial geologist who took on that responsibility for climate, but he needed a glaciologist to calculate the thickness and elevation of ice over the areas that he mapped in conjunction with other people, primarily Bjorn Anderson from Norway. And he still remains collaborating with Bjorn to this very day, I believe. And Bjorn and Al collaborated on a book called The Ice Age World. So that connection with Bjorn Anderson includes both Al and George. And there are other Scandinavian glacial geologists who are also contributing to this, Canadian glacial geologists, as well as American ones. So Paul Bieske provided took on the responsibility of determining the aerial extent of the Laurentide ice sheet over North America at that time. And so we published all of that work. But first we presented it at a conference licensed in Ottawa by the International Glaciological Society, and the referees rejected it. Several papers rejected all of them. So George arranged with Wiley Interscience to have all our work published as a book called The Last Great Ice Sheets, a name suggested by John Embry. And so we did. And that book is now a classic. Huh. But it was rejected by the best and the brightest of the glaciological community at the time.
That's funny.
We first presented it in Ottawa.
Was climate funded by the United States, or was it funded by more than one country?
The National Science Foundation primarily. Mm-hmm. I think there were some other sources of money, especially these people from other collaborators, you know, mm-hmm. from other countries.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was primarily.
Sorry about that. Wish people didn't call me. So, do you think, are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so that's what made the University of Maine an irresistible magnet for me.
Mm.
It was a chance to expand my interest in glaciers to the big continental ice sheets where most of the glacier ice is located now and in the past. And then also to link my whatever I would learn about the big ice sheets to climate dynamics in general through all these other people in the old Institute of Polar Studies and the geology department who were interested in anthropology and archaeology and botany and all these other collaborating departments that were also interested in how climate tied all of the various disciplines together. And that's the major reason why the name was changed from the Institute for Quaternary Studies to the Climate Change Institute.
Mm-hmm. So how long were you at the Institute?
36 years.
Uh-huh.
So I joined it almost right after it was founded.
Right.
I'm one of the charter members. The ones who were there at the before I showed up was Dave Sanger in the anthropology archaeology department, and I think Rob Bonison came in just a bit later, but almost the same time. And George Denton, of course, held boards. Ron Davis was the botanist that we had, paleoecologist, the botany department, and.
Steve Norton, maybe?
Steve, no, he hadn't come aboard yet. He came on later. The historian there, Smith.
Dave Smith, yeah.
Dave Smith came on later. I think the ones that I named, I think those were the...
The original founders.
The original, original ones. I may have missed one or two.
So what do you think is the most important contribution the Institute has made over the years?
Well, it's world famous, for one thing. So there's a lot of contributions in all of these fields. There's several disciplines tied up in the Institute, and everyone who represents one of these disciplines would like to think that it's their discipline that's made the major contribution. But I would have to say it would be understanding the history and dynamics of climate change would be the biggest contribution, because mm-hmm. that's the one discipline, as I mentioned earlier, that ties all the others together.
Right.
And that only really became that after Paul Mesky became director, because that was a niche he carved out for himself as a scientist. He was a graduate student in the old Institute of Polar Studies when I was there. In fact, he was down in Antarctica working on his doctoral dissertation when I was down there drilling holes through Missouri Glacier. So I've known him for my entire scientific career. There were some others looking at climate records in ice cores, but they were looking at stable isotopes, oxygen isotope ratios, and deuterium, H3 hydrogen molecule, and things come down with snow or a little ice in very cold, high latitudes. You don't have snow flakes. You have little hexagonal prisms of ice that come down like bullets. They're not plate-like flakes at all. They're like little tiny bullets. And anyway, they all, for the flakes or bullets, they all contain very tiny concentrations of these anions and cations and dust and things of that nature. And of course, then the carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere itself, gets trapped when the snow compresses into ice, because it produces air bubbles in the ice that get recovered from ice cores. So you have a record of not just CO2, but all of the elements of the Earth's atmosphere that existed at the time that snow fell. It was compressed into ice over some years after that. But the trace elements of anions and cations, quite a large number of them, a lot of that was pioneered by Paul and his colleagues. So, allows storm tracks to be tracked, not over the ice sheets as they exist today, which can be mapped with existing storm tracks you can track using satellite technology, but also storm tracks that existed in the past. And for the dust particles, you can get the source of these storms. I mean, these usually come from desert areas in the southern hemisphere, Patagonia and South America and Australia. So you are actually able to produce maps of atmospheric circulation that existed in the past, because there are dating techniques that are pretty reliable for these trace elements, anions and cations, that they can be compared with the results of computer atmospheric circulation models and test how accurate those models are. So it's quite important work he's doing, and I would say that would be the one thing. At the time where that proposal, which originated with Paul, to change the name, the climate changes, and I was one of the few who voiced a reservation, and the reservation was this. I thought it had the potential, if concentrating on the climate science, of sucking all the oxygen out of the other components, other parts, scientific disciplines that made up the Institute and now the Center, because it would attract a lot of money and a lot of attention in the media, and it could I compared it to one of these long sort of hot dog balloons you could buy at carnivals, where you could squeeze all the air one end of the balloon and have it all in the other end, so it looks like a lollipop on a stick. And I thought that there's a possibility that the old Institute of Polar Studies could, Institute for Quaternary Studies, excuse me, could morph into the Climate Change Institute, in which the climate lollipop was so much more visible than the stick, that these other disciplines could basically wither on the vine. But that didn't happen. I think I wasn't the only one aware of that possibility. So I think Paul and others made a conscious effort to make sure that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And as far as I've been gone there since 2010, that is, as far as I can tell, it hasn't happened. All these others are still quite active, and so it's and nobody knew what quaternary meant anyway. Knows what climate means. So there was a visibility dimension to changing the name for marketing purposes, which was important. You know, very important. In fact,
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
What your question actually was, though.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Okay.
We've almost spent an hour, and I don't want to keep you on too long, but I did want to give you a chance to tell me anything I didn't think to ask you that you wanted to be on record.
Well, here's one thing I'd like to be on. I'm not one of these people who's bought into this man-caused global warming as some kind of a disaster for mankind and for the planet Earth. The kind of global warming that we see in climate records in the historical period over which climate records have been actually measured, as opposed to computer models that simulate climates in the past and present and future. And those records, they're not very old. You know, they only go back 100 years or so. And the further back you go, the more sparsely, more sparse the data become, and the more concentrated the data become located in specific places where these measurements were made, which basically means Europe in general, and Western Europe in particular, and the eastern part of North America, eastern United States in particular, and a few other places scattered around the world, but not many. And so it's a very incomplete sampling record, and therefore unreliable. But nonetheless, it's better than nothing. But what my real reservation is about this global warming business is it's not a disaster at all in the making. It would be a great boon for mankind, and these are the reasons why. First, carbon dioxide is oxygen for plants, and so the more oxygen, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the more vigorous plant life will be, which means agricultural productivity. If you want to see the most prolific vegetative times on Earth, it's when the carbon dioxide was higher than it is today. And the Carboniferous and the Permian with the fern forest and all that sort of thing, and the Mesozoic era with the dinosaurs, which needed an awful lot of plant life to stay alive because it's so big and they ate so much. So that's number one. It'll be a great boon for agriculture, and therefore as a food supply for us. And number two, it would thaw the permafrost in Alaska and Arctic Canada and Siberia, which would increase the habitable and productive land area of the Earth's surface substantially, because it's about 1/7 of the land on the Earth's surface is now frozen ground permafrost that can go down thousands of feet. And in the summertime, the top meter of that melts, the thaws and the ice melts, and so it becomes an impassable bog in most of these lands that doesn't allow any kind of overland transportation at all. And because the ice is still on the ground just 3 feet deep, the vegetation can't send down roots more than 3 feet, so that limits the vegetation to dwarfed trees in the Russian taiga and then bushes and that sort of thing, tundra vegetation. But all that land is could be very highly productive. You could have two harvests a summer because you'd have 18 to 24 hours of sunlight for the growing season. And there's enormous mineral wealth and petroleum wealth probably year-round, so ships could get through, and that would cut the distance and time between the our part of the world on the opposite sides of the Atlantic with the Orient. It'd cut all that time and distance in half, and there would be very important seaports then that would be all along the north coast of Canada and Alaska and Russia that would be seaports for the shipping and for shipping out all of the agricultural and mineral wealth of these regions once they thaw and can be drained and become productive. Now, there's no way you can look upon that and call it an impending disaster. So my biggest complaint about this global warming hysteria is that it's presented as some kind of a calamity, a man-caused calamity that will upset the Earth's ecology in a very harmful way, when the exact opposite is the truth, but you never hear that spoken.
That's a very interesting perspective.
And I'll tell you the reason why. And this is something that you might find even more odd, but it's the truth. There is a political reason behind making it, presenting it as a disaster, and that is this. Since the origin of the contraceptive pill and legalized abortion, the countries, the people in the developed part of the world, which means primarily in part of the world where white people live, have stopped reproducing themselves. They would prefer to spare themselves the time and money and energy needed to raise children when they could enjoy the good life that you would have without those burdens. And the reason why the children aren't valued is because they have accepted the Darwinian explanation for human origins and destiny. We came from worms and will be eaten by worms. End of story. And well, if that's the end of the story, what's the point of having children? We'll just become extinct like a lot of other species has anyway. So why not just enjoy the good life while we've got it? Well, the rest of the world that hasn't bought into this ideology are still having children, and they happen to be the part of the world that's not white, primarily. And so there has to be some way to reduce that part of the world's population and give it the appearance of saving the planet rather than a racist ideology that is aimed at preventing these people from having babies and eventually becoming so numerous that white people no longer run things. And you will never see this presented anywhere in the scientific literature, and certainly not in the political literature, but I'm telling you that is what's behind a lot of this presenting global warming as some kind of a disaster for mankind, but in fact it would be a great boon. Now, I think that the scientists, like Paul and others in the Climate Change Institute, and also in the department there, they were now the School of Earth and Climate Sciences, are probably not even aware that, and would find it fantastic to be told that this is what's behind it. But I'm someone who has spent a major part of my life trying to expose the underside of legalized abortion. I've been in prisons in six states for just doing simple sit-ins in front of places where the next generation is being killed by the Kermit Gosnells of the world, if you've heard about him. The media's tried to black out that story of what he was doing there in Philadelphia. But anyway, I'm not ignorant of it. I know what I'm talking about. And that's what's behind it. And ultimately, it's a racist attitude. And the Darwinian explanation for human origins and destiny is itself a racist explanation. The full title of this magnum opus is On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selections, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. That's the full title, which you will never see printed any longer, but that's it. Just Google and you'll see it there. And you know, that was written at a time when the Brits were the great imperialists of the world, subjugating countries or lands all over the world inhabited by people who weren't white. And I've got a 1902 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica right here in this room, my study, where I'm on the phone with you. And I can look up the entry under Negro in that Britannica, and it lists 14 differences between black people and white people. And at the top of the list is that the brain of the average black man is in between that of a gorilla and a white man. That's in the Britannica, mm-hmm. written at the height of British imperialism and when the British Empire was also at its zenith. So this is a dimension of this climate warming hysteria that is at the root of it. That has to be kept concealed. You've heard it. Whether you want it to be included in this interview or not is up to you.
Well, thank you for that. I do appreciate your perspectives. I do have to stop the interview because I have some people waiting for me, but I really enjoyed talking with you and hearing about your experiences with the Climate Change Institute and the Quaternary Institute. So thank you again.
It was a wonderful life.
We will contact you about the release form.
Okay.
And thanks. And if you have any other questions, you've got our email, so you can give us a call or whatever.
Okay. Well, enjoyed it. And enjoy your time there. It'll be the best year of your life if you don't already know it.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye now.